Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Welcome to Podcast, I guess, 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iscove. And with us today is Rebecca Searle, author, TV writer, who also co-developed her TV adaptation of her YA series, Famous in Love. She's also the author of The Dinner List and the New York Times bestseller In 5 Years, which I'm currently reading, and it's great, and everyone should go and buy it. However, they buy books in a pandemic. They should go and buy books. Thank you for being here, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Buy local, guys. Support indie booksellers.
There you go. Yeah. If you can, I'm assuming they're shipping and doing all that sort of
stuff.
Oh,
everywhere. And if you go to bookshop.org, this is just going to turn into a plug for indie booksellers. But if you go to bookshop.org, they have all information. You can type in your zip code. They'll tell you what local stores are open. They'll ship to you. You can do curbside pickup. Buy and support local independent bookstores. We need them.
Hear, hear. Where were you in 1999 and how did Felicity come into your life?
I was in middle school in 1999. Let's see. I think I was in the eighth grade. It's so pathetic when you look back and you're like, does this happen to you? Like years blend with like 100%. Ages of, I can't, it was in the seventh or eighth grade. And Felicity, actually, I will be honest, like didn't come into my life until I think I was properly in high school. Because I grew up in a household that wasn't big on television.
Okay.
So the first show I actually really got into from the WB was Roswell. I know you spoke to Karina. Karina's one of my dearest friends and, who's running the show now and is the best and just like pretty much the smartest person I know. But I was obsessed with the original. I was obsessed with the original. And that was kind of the first show. And I remember a friend of mine used to record the episodes on VHS for me and give them to me because we didn't have, not that it was on cable. There was no cable back then, but my parents had a pretty strict, like no TV rule. And so I would like sneak, I couldn't guarantee that I could be in front of the TV at the time. Of course, there was no TiVo.
There was no TiVo. It's true.
Right.
It's true.
That wasn't a thing. So Russell was first, followed probably by Dawson's Creek. And I came to Felicity maybe a few years later.
It's so funny you talking about like lack of TiVo and recording stuff on VHS, which I did. I recorded every episode of ER for about 6 seasons, but be that as it may, it's interesting how you had to be in front of your television. Like there was actual appointment television, right? Where people just sat down at 8 o'clock and they watched 3 hour blocks of television, which obviously was a huge boon to advertisers. And now like nothing is appointment television. I mean,
nothing.
I guess there's an argument to be made for maybe your HBO shows, some HBO shows, but even then,
right?
Who's really doing
kind of Game of Thrones, and that's been it. Oh, I think over the last 5 years,
it's pretty crazy. Yeah,
it's pretty crazy. And I mean, I think Buffy was probably the biggest example of that back then. Sure. I mean, that was serious. And I was not a Buffy fan, but I know people who were back then could tell you exactly what day and time and night that show was on.
100%.
Yeah.
So you watched Felicity as it was airing or after on like DVD?
I think it was there 4 seasons of Felicity. I think it was probably right after it aired. I started watching it. And I really do. I mean, like so many millennials before me, I think it impacted my decision to want to go. I ended up going to undergrad in Los Angeles at USC, but I moved after college to New York. And I think it impacted my decision to want to like be a young person in New York City.
In this idyllic version of New York City that was actually shot in Los Angeles.
Right, exactly, exactly. But it was, I mean, you know, I remember first moving to New York as a 22-year-old and passing Dean and DeLuca on, you know, West Broadway and thinking, sure, this was Mecca.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's really, I had never eaten at a Dean. I'm from Toronto originally, so we didn't have Dean and DeLuca in Toronto. So it just felt even more special whenever I was in New York and actually got to eat there. It was just this like amazing thing. So you watched it sort of afterwards as opposed to when it was on. And I guess I have to ask you just based on your book, which as I said, is fantastic.
Yeah.
It does have kind of a time travel component to it. So my question to you is, how do you feel about Felicity's use of time travel at the end of the series? Do you feel
not
like
great. You're not great? I mean, I guess I don't, I just, it's just a grand mystery. And I understand, I've done the research, like what happened and they got these extra episodes ordered and they went back to the drawing board and they are, but I mean, the end of, so how many time travel episodes are there? 3 or 4?
It's 4.
There's 4. So the episode right before we launch into the Bizarro Land is a perfect finale.
Yeah.
And so I in subsequent rewatchings of the show, which I did a complete rewatch 2 years ago in preparation for a project I didn't tell you about, but I feel like the show stops there for me.
Oh, so okay. So you just think the time travel thing is like an epilogue, like it's not even really part of the show.
I think it's like, honestly, I've come to look at it as like not canon. It's like fan fiction or something. I just can't abide that like being part of the like original Enterprise. I don't know. Have you had a person come on here who's like a fan of?
I don't know that I've had, thus far, I don't think I've had anyone come on that, actually, you know what? I feel like Amy Smart or Amy Jo Johnson, one of the actors, was a fan of it.
Oh,
because I think that it might have been, I imagine if you were an actor on the show, it might have been fun to do the sliding doors thing.
Right.
I would even argue that as a writer, it might have been fun to do it.
Yes.
But as a viewer.
As a viewer, it was really.
As a viewer, it sucks. Because a viewer
just a real, yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting too, and you obviously use the device in your book, but just it's such a perfect device to be able to show the what if, like what's the path not taken. It's just such and emotionally it's so potent. So I get why they did what they did, even if to your point, and I agree with you, what?
Yeah, like, exactly. That is the point. What? But I can also understand it in terms of a love triangle, right? Like, and wanting to see like what might have an alternate, because the whole thing was about who's she going to choose, which one is it going to be? So
right.
I mean, yes. I all your points, and also what?
Yeah. It's also just it goes too far with it, like killing Noel. Like it just goes too far. but listen, I respect the swing. I'm a big fan of shows that take risks.
Yeah.
So I respect that. So, what are your feelings about the show sort of in general? How do you feel? Cause you were sort of, I was in my first year of university when Felicity started. So it was concurrent with my 4 years of college experience. It was not my college experience. at all. I went to film school in Toronto, and you know, it was not like Felicity. Did you feel as though it in any way sort of informed your college experience?
Well, one thing I'll say is that I identified with Felicity because I think that I was also a very late bloomer in the way she was.
Sure.
And I think, like, you know, I think about this a lot in terms of quote unquote teen television and what it looks like now, and how you really, it would be very challenging to create a show around a character who had never been in love, had never had sex, had never like done any of those things in high school, sure, and comes to college and is that sort of like fresh face and new. And I think part of the reason that the show worked really well in that time is that it really appealed to high schoolers and people who are older, because it was reflecting an inward experience that felt in some ways younger maybe than the like chronological age of how old Felicity was. But she also was in college having all of these like very sort of classic collegiate experience. So I really identified with the fact that she just hadn't experienced that many things. It's how, sure, I felt. And I sort of, you know, I sometimes miss, I think, characters that come that are characters. And I also just think this speaks more grandly to like the pacing of the show, how like delicate and slow it was.
I know. I love it so much.
I know. We just don't really have that anymore. So
it's very true. You know, I was talking with Karina about this actually. You know, we talked about how much air there is in the show.
Yeah.
Whereas she's like, I couldn't do any of the things that they're doing on Roswell now. Like, they're not allowed to have a breath between something else happening. And then on the flip side, I just recently watched Normal People, which I don't know if you've had a chance to check out. But that show really takes its time and allows itself to kind of sit in these moments. And to your point about sort of teen television, I do like to think that we have now, with a streaming universe and with this idea that the companies and the studios know that teens watch streaming television,
right,
we're getting more shows that explore the youth experience in a more poetic and a more nuanced way. But to your point, we have not had that basically since Felicity left the air.
No, we haven't. I mean, there are whole, like, there are act outs where it's like someone just looks at someone else, you know, like, and that's the act out. Like, that's the whole thing.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. I mean, yeah, on Famous in Love, it's like, you know, who's plotting whose murder at the end of Act Two? Like, you know, so, I mean, really, like, it was just, who's going to be locked in a basement this episode? You know, and I also think, and Karina and I have spoke about this a lot too, like, the teen experience is so different than it was for us. Like, they live in a much more, in just a more fast paced world, a more chaotic world. More is required of them, like, socially, economically, in so many ways that are, I think, different from what the pace was and what our concerns were and what our worldview was when we were growing up. And I understand the ways in which that television wants to reflect that and sort of reflect the place of the world. Simultaneously, I think the success of Normal People is a great reflection of the fact that we are all really missing some calmer entertainment.
Yes. Yeah. I think we're missing also just, I don't know, romance that's a little more believable, you know, that relationships between, I mean, obviously it doesn't have to be same sex relationships or what have you, but like, we're just missing the sort of spectrum of romance.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit binary right now in terms of like what, and that's exciting. And hopefully we'll see more of that as we go deeper into these streaming wars that we seem to be in right now. But it is really lovely to watch Felicity and be able to sort of, it's a very inviting, very warm show. It obviously has, you know, everyone's wearing great sweaters. It's all autumnal colors. It's all very inviting, but it does have those.
I feel like you just said that and I was like, oh my God, is it the 90s version of like a Nancy Myers movie? Is it like
a little bit,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely, yeah. I imagine that. Yeah, it's like a 90s college version of a Nancy Myers movie, for sure. yeah, It's Complicated is really just that, but like years later.
Totally.
But yeah, it's really interesting to watch it again. And you know, I'm excited to talk about this specific episode with you because, you know, Obviously, she cut her hair. It was a big deal. And sure. And which in and of itself speaks volumes to how low stakes this show was, that like she cut her hair and everyone lost their fucking minds. But
Can I say something on the haircut?
Please.
I heard Carrie Russell on Dax Shepard's podcast, which I love. And she told the story about the haircut. And I think the narrative was always Carrie Russell and Scott Speedman were like, you know, got crazy. And he like, they decided that she should cut her hair and like it wasn't sanctioned. And then she came back and they had to like rate it into the show. And it was like a huge ratings issue and blah, blah, blah. But in reality, the producers went to her and said, hey, we think this should be a plot point. Are you down? So I think it speaks to a lot of things, which is like, I never knew that. And I think there were less outlets back there for actors to get to, like nowadays you would just go on social media and say like, hey, this is what happened. Or, you know, you'd give an interview. We just didn't have the same amount of access to actors, and they didn't have the same amount of like, they didn't have the same platform to be able to like express the realities of a situation. But that kind of blew my mind, because all these years I thought this was just like a crazy thing she did in her youth. Yeah. But it was a whole plot point.
100%. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you know, you and I working in television now, obviously just looking at it and saying, well, the timing doesn't actually make sense, right? Like, they shot a whole first premiere episode, and so, like, it wouldn't have made sense for her to, like, go. So it doesn't make sense. But putting that aside, I agree with you. I remember that rumor. Like, I remember it being tagged to her as like this actress doing this crazy thing, which is fucked up when you think about it.
But,
you know, and it's crazy to think that now, even Karina said this on the episode I had with her when she was on, she said there are still clauses at Warner Brothers saying you cannot have haircuts by any character without it being sanctioned by like X amount of people. Like, there's a fallout from this Felicity situation that we still
the haircut clause. I love it.
Which is just unbelievable.
That's unbelievable.
But it's so we're at this point in the season where we're still sort of working our way through this sort of grenades that have gone off at the top of season two, where she breaks up with Ben, she cuts her hair, she drops pre-med. And they really kind of sort of blow the show up, for lack of a better way of putting it, which is great television, right? Like, that's great writing, and that's what you want in a writer's room. So I completely understand why they did it. I also understand why every 16-year-old that was watching it was like, what the fuck is this?
Sure.
This is not the show I signed up for.
We weren't used to it. It wasn't really how stories were told then. And actually, it's interesting because when you say that, I'm like, it's starting to make the time travel at the end a little bit more justified. I'm like, whoa, were they always a show that took major risks? Maybe they were.
I mean, in their own little sandbox, kind of.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But so in this particular episode, which is called The Depths, it's episode 204. I'm going to read a brief synopsis for the people that haven't seen it. But when Felicity and Julie get stuck in a subway together for hours, their friendship is dissected by a bunch of eccentric strangers. Julie finally manages to forgive Felicity. Noel and Ruby spend a wonderful day together at the museum that concludes with a kiss. And Ben clashes with a cranky customer played by Terry Polo. The Depths aired on October 17th, 1999. It was written by J.J. Abrams and directed by Michael Schultz. So I'm a big fan of a bottle episode. I love a bottle episode. I wrote one for Station 19 a couple years ago, and I just love sticking a bunch of people in a room and just watching the fireworks of the various sort of dramas that exist between those people. It's very much like a play, but it gives you freedom to be able to do some real digging into character and what have you. And I think they did a great job of that in this episode. How did you think? Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I love it too. It reminds me, as I was like rewatching it in preparation for us to chat, I was thinking a lot about the episode of Dawson's Creek where Joey and Pacey get locked in the Walmart. Do you remember that episode? You weren't a huge Dawson's Creek person.
I watched them, but I wasn't as big.
It's this episode, and it's like, it's so late in the series run. I think it's probably I think it's probably season 5, but they get like extenuating circumstances, I don't really remember, but they get locked in this Walmart together, and they have this whole night where they're just like, you know, they have to like pull out sleeping bags, and she like shaves beard. They share this kiss, like this real intimacy. Anyway, I was thinking about it, and it was reminding me of that. And I love a bottle episode too.
That sounds a lot like the movie Career Opportunities. Have you ever seen that movie by any chance? Jennifer Connelly. It's a John Hughes movie. Like before he went full Home Alone. Basically, she gets trapped in a Target. With this guy, and they fall in love. I think the movie's like 84 minutes with credits. There's not a lot that you can do with that movie, but it's still fun. But yeah, I love a bottle episode. I think that thematically, I'm also a fan of the fact that this show, and I would argue that a lot of JJ shows use their titles really smartly. This is obviously about them being stuck in the subterranean subway tunnels, but it's also about them being in Friendship Hell. It's about them sort of being in the depths of their relationship, which I really liked. It also works and services quite well as a clip show in its own weird way of like filling you in on everything that's happened up until this point. So if there are people that haven't seen the show or what have you, they can kind of jump in, which is smart. Sure. So, I mean, I guess from 30,000 feet, I think the episode works quite well in terms of just, moving Felicity and Julie closer to friendship, moving them back together. She obviously in the previous episode kind of mends things with Noel, which apparently is essentially connected to the fact that he found another girl. Well, had he not found Ruby, perhaps he wouldn't be so open to mending things.
In the 90s, we still had a lot of work to do.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yes.
And yes, we do still.
Yeah, yes, we do. Absolutely.
But yeah, it was... what are your thoughts on the Noel Ruby of it all?
It was interesting because in rewatching it, I was remembering that episode because I was remembering like Julie says or someone. I was remembering that I thought that that Noel and Felicity were in a better place, but he's still really salty with her in this
episode. He's a little prickly still.
He's prickly, and it's funny because. I think at the time watching it, I was sort of like, it made him less appealing to me. I think television of the WB era was so used to men who were just constantly bleeding for these women who just were so unshakable and unrattled and just like kind of just like expressing unconditional love. I think about, you know, obviously I'm going to keep bringing this up, but PC was my like be all and end all.
You and Karina.
And I kind of liked it. I've liked it on subsequent rewatches. The fact that he's a little bit like, I'm kind of pissed at you. Good thing. I liked Ruby then and I like her now. Is that a controversial point of view? Like, I don't know.
I don't think so. But I will say that at the time, it did feel like, I mean, and the show lives and dies based on the Team Ben, Team Noel of it all. I mean, that is its, you know, bread and butter.
Yeah.
I want to hear your thoughts on that. But I do think that, you know, you had to make a choice, or at least they made a choice at the end of season one, right? And she chose to go with the guy that she followed to New York, which is not a huge surprise. But they saw more opportunity in story that way than her being with Noel, which sort of makes sense since all of season one is her essentially being with Noel. Yeah. So it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it also makes sense to want to make Noel quote unquote happy and, you know, with somebody else. The Ruby thing, and we had Amy Smart on a couple weeks ago, and she talked about the role and being a part of it and how much fun it was. And I think she's great. And I actually would argue that she kind of gets the shitty end of the stick. Like, they don't write her out great.
Yeah. I agree. She's a little bit of a filter. I mean, the other thing about it is, like, Noel is really his best when he's being a boyfriend. We love watching Noel be a boyfriend.
Yes.
It's very pleasurable to watch him be a boyfriend, whether, you know, it's to Felicity or to Jennifer Garner or, you know, it is pleasurable. So I think that's part of the Ruby storyline that I like and still find appealing, is getting to watch him in that role. But you're right. There's not a ton of work for her to do in it.
And it's funny you say that, because I think that Noel, I agree, we want to watch him as a boyfriend and we don't want to watch Ben as a boyfriend.
No, Ben is.
So that's part of the problem. Or maybe that's part of an asset, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, but that's so interesting, isn't it? The juxtaposition of the Ben relationship is the best when they are just longing for each other and can't be. And the Noel relationship is the best when they are. It's very nice to watch them together. You want to watch Ben just, like, you know, are we allowed to swear on here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I fuck her across the room. Like, those are very different things.
He's also, someone else, and I, forgive me, I don't remember which guest it was, calls Ben a fuckboy, and he really kind of is. Yeah. I mean, that's really sort of it. There's not a whole lot more going on there.
No, he's so handsome.
He's very handsome. don't disagree. It's because he's Canadian. But I think that... It's interesting to watch the Noel situation with Ruby, because to your point, it breeds obviously some jealousy in Felicity to a certain degree, which again feeds the love triangle. You know, the Ruby thing, and Amy Smart mentioned this in my interview with her, that she actually had to go off to do, I think it was Road Trip was the movie that she was in.
Remember that movie.
And so she asked to leave to go do that. And that literally is what the character does, which is she goes off to be in a movie,
right,
and then she gets knocked up by a movie producer. Yeah. And I wonder if she didn't ask to leave, would she have stayed on the show? Would they have just made her a series regular? Would they have found a way to sort of, because she really does fold really nicely into the universe.
Yes.
And I would argue that keeping Noel in a relationship for longer might have actually benefited the show. But
I agree. And I think that's interesting. I also think it's interesting to watch her relationship with Felicity, because Felicity is a little bit of a mentor to her, but then there's this other, like you were saying, there's this jealousy, and it's very interesting. Like, it's, we haven't really watched Felicity in like a super jealous role before. She's been, I don't know, almost like disturbingly angelic but it is like, there's something really compelling, and you can't, you know, because Amy Smart's so great, you can't really help but fall in love with, like, she's so sweet and loving, and Felicity can't help but love her. So I think that would have been interesting to see.
And I think that it pays off well in this episode too, in the sense that, you know, at the end of the episode, the storyline is basically Noel and Felicity and Ruby are supposed to go to the museum together. Felicity gets stuck in the subway, so Noel and Ruby are stuck together, and they have this lovely day at the museum, and then they end up kissing and falling in love. And then she runs to Felicity at the end and talks about how adorable Noel is and how wonderful and how great he is. And Felicity does not tell her that she obviously has a past with this guy, which ultimately comes up later. But for the time being, she keeps it to herself because she doesn't want to ruin this thing that Ruby has right now. And that goes to show, again, how big-hearted Felicity's character is, that she doesn't want to destroy this sort of, you know, moment that she has. So to pivot to the A story, which is essentially Felicity and Julie are stuck in a subway train dealing with their problems.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on, what are your thoughts on the Felicity-Julie relationship as a whole? Because I have thoughts.
The Felicity-Julie relationship as a whole.
Well, as a woman, and as someone who was watching it when you were sort of around this age, and now watching it, obviously, you know, how does it play for you?
Well, Julie, I think, as a character, I think she got the rough end of the stick in a lot of ways, because they were throwing a lot of social issues at her that I think that they weren't, I feel like we would do such a better job of culturally unpacking now.
Sure.
Like, I think that a lot of it was just after school specials. And that makes it challenging. And I think that she also, the ways in which she continuously sort of just like service Felicity's storyline, despite the fact that she was going through some like super fucking dark shit, would be problematic, you know, on a television show now.
Yeah.
It would be.
Absolutely. I mean, So I guess, but yes to all of that. And I think that what I love in this episode is that the show has the balls to kind of go straight at this relationship and say, you guys aren't really friends.
Like, right.
You think you're friends, but you've known this person for a year at best. And like, you're not really friends. You're just kind
of. I love the man who somebody says that. I don't know if we're allowed to skip around chronologically.
Yeah. We can jump around. Yeah.
But I love at the end when he says that. He's like, you have no idea what best friendship is.
Right.
You know, my best friend and I were best friends for 60 years. You guys have been friends for a year. Like, you're just figuring out whether or not, like, you want to love each other.
Or even like each other, or even want to hang out with each other.
Yeah.
It's, and, you know, obviously that sort of underlining that idea of, and I'm sure you had these, I had these in college, where you're desperate for friendship, right? Like, you're in a new space, you're with all these people you don't know, you're looking for life rafts anywhere that you can find them. And you become friends with people that, like, you just might never be friends with ever again, but like, they're there for you in that moment and you move on with your life. And I do think that the show does a good job of kind of highlighting that and at least owning that. Because to your point, Julie's character, you know, she's got the date rape storyline, she's got the adoption storyline, like, she's got a lot of tropey storylines, unfortunately. Even though I think they handle the date rape thing in a pretty nuanced way, but it's tricky terrain, and in 99 to be talking about that stuff is interesting.
Yeah, that is very true. That is very true. I mean, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking I had a whole set of, there were like four friends of mine my freshman year of college, and I don't talk to any of them anymore. I mean, they're lovely girls and they were wonderful. We were everything to each other because we were, like you're saying, like, we were life rafts. We were just trying to, like, get by, like, get to some kind of, like, establishment of normalcy.
Yeah.
And then once you're on land, you're like, okay, now I'm going to go find my people. And of course, when you're writing a show, and what was interesting about Felicity, obviously, is that it didn't start in high school, it started in college. So as opposed to all these shows where in season 3, 4, 5, tried to, like, make the characters go to college and then have the exact same life they had in high school, except for, like, maybe inject a boyfriend or two, was really bizarre. There is, like, a similar idea, and I think Felicity handled it well, where, like, the characters are growing and changing so much over the course of those 4 years, and they're not always, like, the permutations of that friend group changes and evolves, not just who dates one another, but, like, who's really close with one another, too.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and so I also, you know, I also really like, I think it's, like, in this episode when Felicity says to Julie, like, you forgave... Like you live with Ben, like, you forgave Ben. Yeah. And what does that mean? Because it's true. It's still how we deal with female betrayal when it comes to romantic relationships. Like, we forgive the man, and it's like on the woman. It's like, it's a girl thing to deal with.
Yeah. There's a couple.
I just said 100 things. I'm sorry.
No. I agree with, I want to unpack all of them. So I want to jump to the train for a second, because something you said made me think of this. There's a guy who says that Julie's a sex toy. Do you remember this? Do you remember this line?
Can we have a little surrounding context? Because I really want to. Hold on. So, what is it?
Okay. They're in the train. Yeah. And there's this, and she's talking about, someone says, a lawyer says to her, asked why Julie forgave Ben and not Felicity.
Yeah, he's trying to, like, litigate the whole thing.
Right. And then Julie is self-aware enough to acknowledge that she's had more male friends than girlfriends, and that Felicity, for all intents and purposes, is one of her first female best friends, quote unquote. And then this guy sitting next to them says, I've dated girls like you. You're like a sex toy. Like, basically, it's their way of saying, like, and I don't know how to say this delicately, but there are girls that have lots of male friends. There are girls that feel perhaps empowered or feel like they're, I don't know, they just like having male attention rather than female attention.
Right.
And that's not a judgment. Those people exist, and that's totally fine. And I think they're trying to comment on that.
Yes.
But not in a way that is particularly or nuanced.
Right.
But I guess my question is, They're really kind of throwing a lot of stuff at Julie in this episode, which I think is really interesting. And I'm looking forward to continuing to watch how they deal with that, or if they deal with that.
Right.
But I guess the question I'm sort of positing to you is, you know, what do you think about the kind of the stereotype or the depiction of a girl who likes to have lots of male friends and enjoys the attention of men, maybe more so than women, and that can create problems with the friendships they have with women?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's particularly pronounced in Felicity because Felicity is someone who's been so sheltered from men her whole life. You know, like she has like basically no sexual experience. Julie has a very, they come from extraordinarily different places, just like in their own sexuality and how they feel about that. So I think it becomes even more pronounced. And I think that what's sort of interesting about the relationship and what's interesting about the writers is that like, they're aware of that. And there'll be moments, I think, where they kind of call it out or use it a little bit against each other. And I don't think that's bad. I think that's actually kind of compelling because it feels real. And it's also an opportunity to get to like name it and talk about it, which I find to be interesting. Yeah, it's actually like now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, what a friendship.
Yes, what a friendship.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I don't know. Like it makes for good television. I'm not sure that people like that could stay friends. Like, I don't know that these two people could stay friends for much longer after sort of all of this drama that's transpired between them, but
yes. Yeah.
I do love, so the episode opens with Felicity drawing herself, her eye for her drawing class. I really love that first extreme close-up of her eye, very filmic. And it's a great cold open with Megan regaling Felicity about this song that she heard Julie sing, shit-talking her. It's great. The slut of Washington Square Park is a ridiculous lyric.
Yes. Can I also just say, it's really fun to watch Felicity get mad in that scene. Because we so infrequently see her show any kind of she's so infrequently feisty. And in that first scene, she's like getting kind of pissed. She's like annoyed. Mm-hmm. She's like, wait, what? She called me what? And we see her like there's an edge to her that we up until that point, we've like very rarely gotten from Felicity. Because I think she's like working her way out of it. She's still very much entrenched with like the season one kind of like calm angel vibe she has going on. So I like that first scene. I like that she gets a little bit irate about it.
I totally agree with you. I love that there are moments where you see like real anger in Felicity.
Yes.
And in those moments, I see the Elizabeth Jennings or the future Elizabeth Jennings in Carrie Russell, where you're just like, oh, there's like a real fucking darkness. Like this, she could really go there if she wants to. I love that. I love that Elena had a poem written about her called Stinky Girl, which I think is just ridiculous, but also makes me think of Smelly Cat, which is obviously.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
So then we meet Terry Polo playing this woman named Maggie, who's coming in asking for obscene amounts of pastry that could never be turned around in the amount of time that she's asking for them. 150 brownies in a matter of hours is not a possible, like for Dean and DeLuca, it's just not possible. I don't know why they would be asking but anyway. And she's kind of like bitchy to Ben. And the storyline is basically Ben meets a bitchy older woman and is kind of smitten with her maybe. Yeah. And then goes to a party where he sticks out like a sore thumb.
Right. Bless.
But that feels like that's his storyline for the episode.
Sure. Great storyline, to be totally honest with you.
I like the Maggie storyline, the Terry Polo storyline.
Yeah, and I like how it evolves actually too. Like she sticks around for a little bit. But I like also when Ben kind of like in the second scene, Ben kind of kicks back at her and is like, hey, like you can't come in demanding that. Like I'm a real person, I work here, I'm on a break, you can see that. And you know, I think it's what ultimately leads to them subsequently becoming romantically entangled.
She's like, totally. Yeah. And also that he's a really hot 20-year-old, basically.
So hot.
He's having a scene with Sean talking about smooth A's for the first time, which will.
Oh, Sean! I mean, it's so good. It's so good.
Prominently as we move forward in series. I like the Terry Polo stuff. I mean. I mentioned this up top in the season premiere, but I think that, you know, the boldness of breaking up Ben and Felicity really forces both of them to sort of reevaluate themselves and try to figure out the people that they want to be. And in turn, I think that ultimately the season is about Ben growing up a little bit and like trying to realize that, you know, I guess trying to figure out how he can be with Felicity, or at least be worthy of Felicity, since he clearly is not at the top of this season.
Yeah.
And Terry Polo's character obviously is a part of that growth.
Yeah. I also think that this might be an unpopular opinion, but I always felt like Ben's emotional development like felt really honest to me. Like it felt believable. Totally. It did not feel believable that they would get there and he'd be like, oh my God, you know, this random girl from high school. Like it felt believable that he would be like a little bit weirded out by that and then a little bit compelled by that. And then like getting to know her and then thinking like there's something interesting here. And then all of it felt just really organic to me. And it felt like they, you know, I mean, this is a testament to slow storytelling and the fact that like we had the patience to kind of wait that out. But it felt like they really kind of earned the turns that he took towards her over the course of seasons one
totally.
And two.
I completely agree. And I think that, again, a testament to, as your point, slower, more patient storytelling allowed this show to exist for 4 years. I mean, this show, which could obviously not exist today in its current form. I mean, it's crazy to even just look at the pilot and think about how much story they burned through in the pilot.
Yeah.
You're just like, you're kind of done. Like you've paired her up already. You've given her like, it's kind of crazy that they found a way to, for lack of a better way of putting it, milk this show for four seasons, considering what transpires, which is not a whole lot. So I think it's great that Julie writes and performs this song, but I still think it's pretty shitty that she does it. Now, the question is whether or not what she did is shittier than what Felicity did. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, technically, Julie and Ben were broken up. What are your thoughts on how bad it was what Felicity did?
I mean, I think it almost doesn't matter because these are two 19-year-old girls who like, that stuff's going to be painful regardless. Like, it would be painful if they were broken up for 6 months. It would be painful if they were broken up for 2 weeks. It would be painful if they weren't broken up at all. Right. And it was cheating. Like, it almost doesn't really matter what the circumstances are because I think that situation is just so unbelievably loaded. That being said, like, I do think that, you know, Julie and Ben were no longer in anything that you could name as a couple and that... Yep. You know, and then everyone kind of knew that there was this thing between Felicity and Ben and this thing that is sort of inevitably going to take shape in some form or another. And I don't just think that's us, the audience. Like, I do think that there's an awareness in their group, too. No?
I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, it does feel a little bit like both sides recognize that what they did is shitty and they do come to that realization by the end of the episode. And thankfully, I appreciate that this episode isn't pat about it. It doesn't sort of wrap it up with a bow. It doesn't make them besties by the end of the episode. I think that's commendable.
She says, do you want to get a coffee? And Julie's like, no, I'm gonna go back to the dorms. No.
So I, you know, and, you know, obviously Felicity says that on her tape to Sally at the end, you know, that, you know, it's, at that point, she felt like Julie and her were at an impasse. And then, you know, at the end, we'll talk about the very end of it in a bit. But just that the show sort of has the courage of its convictions to do the things that it's doing. A lot of shows, especially, you know, you're a big hit show, then you take all these kind of crazy swings at the top of your season two. And that takes a lot of courage. And I like that the show has the conviction to do that. I think that... there's a guy on the train. So they get trapped on the train. There's a guy on the train that immediately says to them, like, shut the fuck up. You have champagne problems.
Yes.
And then some woman's like, he's right. I've seen Rent. Now, my feeling is that he had a point that she then undercuts with a topical joke that is fine, I guess, but then like defeats the purpose of this guy who's got like real problems to deal with. And these two snobby girls are like bitching about a boy.
Yes. Yeah.
I appreciate that someone at least calls them out on it.
I agree. I appreciate that too. And it's like, you know, down there, I think it's like also an interesting microcosm of New York City. And I think that it's a little bit one of the things that the show does is broaden the scope a little bit in that episode and say like, okay, even though this is it's interesting. It's sort of this interesting dichotomy because even though it's a bottle episode, it's actually like the broadest you know, it's sort of like, it's sort of the broadest scope that we've actually really seen in some ways.
Yep.
Because it shows us New York in a way it was in the late 90s, which is like a New York that is diverse, that is economically diverse, that is, you know, that's coming from all different areas and, you know, like social backgrounds. And I think that there's something really interesting about them being, you know, again, like easily and kindly, because this is the WB, confronted with that.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I think it's, you know, I like that it's kind of dirty and grimy, that it feels like a New York City pre-Giuliani. And I love the way they shoot the actual subway itself. Yeah. You know, a lot of shows wouldn't perhaps have the budget or the wherewithal to have, you know, shots of the tunnel, shots of the train moving, really feeling like some of the distance in the tunnels, it would be shot in such a way that it was clearly a stationary one car on a soundstage. And this feels like it has some breadth to it, and it feels lived in and feels like a real subway, which is things that people don't necessarily notice, but adds to authenticity and makes it feel real. Yeah. I think that a lawyer then asks Julie to perform the song so that they can all figure out who's in the right and who's in the wrong. And I love that we don't hear the song. I think it's great that we don't hear the song. It is so much better to imagine the song and to have them picking apart pieces of it than it is to have
lingering in our heads. And
so good. It's so smart to do that. And this is when Julie starts talking about having lots of male friends, but I like that Julie and Felicity are both going to the museum weirdly. Mm-hmm.
Weirdly.
And that woman feeling that their fate is what trapped them in this subway.
I mean, I'm a huge like destiny fate person. So like that really speaks to me. I love that about this. Mm-hmm. And I always like, you know, the end time travel notwithstanding, like there was something a little, sometimes a tiny bit magical about Felicity. Like there was something that existed occasionally just on the periphery of reality that they played with a little bit. And I think that this is like one of our introductions to that.
I completely agree with you. I think they do it a little bit at the end of season one with Megan, where she does the spell.
You're right.
And it's like, there's like a hint of the supernatural that, to your point, adds just a little bit of magic to the show that gives you that serendipity kind of like, is there something bringing these people together that's larger than them?
Yeah.
Which I really love.
And which is also so, it's so New York City too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it is, you know, it's a New York that I think, when we think about New York and the romanticism of New York, like we do think about it existing on a little bit of like the edge of reality. There is magic to it. There is like, it's a city of 9 million people. And yet it's a city like full of kismet and bumping into each other. And I love that about New York. I lived there for 12 years. I just moved to Los Angeles like 6 months ago. So, and I'm
thrilled.
Yeah. Well, now I'm very glad.
The magic of it is really special.
Yeah, and I always thought that was, I keep referencing this interview, but the Carrie interview with Dax, where she talked about the fact that she then, I guess, after the show wrap, like officially moved to New York, and that they didn't actually do a lot of shooting there. That they were like, they were just not there that often. And I mean, maybe I'm getting that wrong, but I think that they did such a good job also of capturing, I mean, a particular New York, but even the fact that they were left in the dorm so much of the time, like it's a very New York show. I mean, it's not Friends. It's just not. It is still a New York show. Like when I watch it now, I feel nostalgia for the New York of my 20s.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, the Friends illusion, because I think there's something sort of, I mean, obviously Friends is a sitcom. It's a heightened reality.
Sure,
you know, it's all sound stages and what have you. But it doesn't even for a set, like they never, and that show was colossally successful. They never went for one exterior to New York. They'd have those establishing shots.
Yeah.
You'd be like, I guess it's New York. Like it's
so egregious. I mean, we shot Famous in Love on the Warner Brothers lot, where like, you know, the Friends, like the New York street was where they shot all of Friends. Mm-hmm. It's just like, when you see it in person and you're also like trying to shoot it yourself, you realize just like the absolute insanity of trying to make that be New York City for every single episode of the same show. Yep. It's wild.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, we shot Station 19 in Los Angeles.
Right.
We had, you know, we went to Seattle once or twice, shot a couple, you know, exteriors, and that was that. But it's to your point, it's not a priority anymore, it seems, in broadcast as much to convey believably that it is the city that you're shooting in. It's an unfortunate reality, but that's just the way that it is.
Yeah.
But this show, to its credit, embraces this sort of magical kind of pseudo New York place of their dreams that also just feels just believable enough. And they went to New York for a handful of scenes. When they shot outside, I think they were
there. Okay. Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that. Speaking of sort of the weirdness, I guess, of the show, we now have a moment that is never spoken of again, where we see all these weirdos in the subway tunnels, and then Megan's hanging out with them.
It's so great.
I love it, but I'm just like, what's happening? She's living with mole people for like, I don't know.
It's so amazing. I mean, but I love, like, you know, to your point about the end of season one, like, I love when Megan, I think they're like not, there are a few Megan threads that are never really like strung, that never really like finalize. It's just like, here's Megan, like, living underground, and it's like, okay, I guess that's a thing that's happening.
It just, it's to me, there's a part of me that feels like, and I've said this on many episodes before, but how much fun it must have been to write Megan, because as a writer, you're just like, oh yeah, they're in the subway, and then those crazy people that live in the subways, and Megan's just hanging out with them, and then we never talk to them again.
Yeah.
It's like, sure.
I think everyone would be like, definitely, that makes sense. And to some extent, even Felicity is sort of like, that's crazy, but like, I guess kind of checks out. Like, I don't know. There's no follow-up from her either. She's not like, hold on, wait a second, is that Megan? Like, there's no, it's just sort of like, you? Okay.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I adore it. I think it is, so I'm going to say one thing here. This is my one big, perhaps, pet peeve about this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love that we have a quote-unquote magical older black man dispensing wisdom. It's not the best look in the world. It's 1999, and I get it, and it was a different time. But it's unfortunate. I understand wanting to have an older person dispensing wisdom and all of that, but it's proven to be not great when it comes to the African-American depiction. Yeah. So it is what it is.
Yeah.
But what it actually does, I don't have an issue with. In fact, I quite like the purpose that it serves for story. Yeah. And as we talked earlier about him sort of saying, like, you're not really friends, you don't really know each other. Blah, blah, blah. I think all of that stuff's great.
Yes.
But that was my only one big.
Yeah. And just having like a larger sort of like scope to, you know, like we're saying this episode does, just being like, you're so in the idiocy of what it means to be 19 and you have no idea. Like you're basically squabbling about a weekend and you don't know what friendship is. It's 60 years.
Yeah.
Can I express my two pet peeves of this episode?
Please,
always had?
I want to hear.
First is that at no point, and then they're on that train for, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's close to 6 hours.
Yes.
Okay. So at no point does somebody say, I need water. Because I'll tell you right now, like it's 45 minutes and I'm like desperate for water.
Do you want to get a glass of water?
I mean, truly. No, I have it right here, but thank you. But I'm like, right now. No, right now. Okay. I'm just saying, in general in my life, like 45 minutes go by and I'm desperate for water. So that's insane to me. I don't understand it. The other is the casualness with which everyone exits the train and no one has to pee. So I can't believe it. But it's always really bothered me that nobody is like running to pee after that. She's like, do you want to go get a coffee? And I'm like, what's happening? You need a hydrate and you need to pee. That is math.
Yeah.
Science. And every time I watch the episode, I notice it. So that's all. Those are my
pet. Here's what I appreciate, that both of your pet peeves are bladder oriented.
Yes,
I
they
appreciate
are.
That.
Totally.
That's great. They're both hydration oriented, which is completely fair. I agree with you that it does feel like I'm gonna piggyback on what you just said and say that I take issue with the way they leave that train, like they're all family now,
right,
is a little much to me.
Yes, I know. They're like exchanging numbers and someone's giving someone else like legal counsel. And, it's a little much,
but you know, listen, it's still broadcast television, but it's a little much. At the end of the episode, we go to the museum. We see Felicity by herself. She's looking at a photograph. Mm-hmm. And Julie comes up to her and admits that the song was mean and that she's not going to play it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I really love the final shot of the episode. It's a wide shot of them on either side of this photograph of a man holding his hand out, which almost looks like he's telling them to stay apart and not to still, you know, so there's argument in that. And it's just it's a very aesthetically pleasing shot, but also really sort of speaks volumes to the fact that these two still have a lot of growing to do before they can be friends, or if they'll even be friends.
Yes. It's very cinematic. And you're right. I like that the episode doesn't try to make any quick mends or ties. It's just sort of like, it's a little bit of time at a time. And it's also just like one really small step. And you know, and I appreciate that about the show as a whole. I think they were never rushing to, draw conclusions about things. I think they were very comfortable letting situations, relationships breathe how they needed to. And I feel like this episode's a really great example of that.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think it's really interesting that the show, you know, obviously there's some pushback, there's some blowback from the choices that they made at the top of season two. And you see that by the end of the season, they bring Felicity and Ben back together again by the top of season three. But, you know, Ben and Felicity moving in together in season three, for instance, is kind of insane. And you see how it tears them apart in their own way and the drama that comes from that. Like, they never really take the easy road on this show in a weird way. They always try to make it difficult for themselves, which, again, leads to great TV, but also makes it a little challenging to the viewers.
Yes. Yes. I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah. It's really, really interesting. Yeah. Were there other shows in 99 that you were, so you said you were watching Dawson's Creek, you were watching Buffy?
Roswell. No. Roswell was like the be-all and end-all for me. It was all about Roswell. Like, I lived
Roswell was your jam.
And died okay. Well, yes, I loved it. It was the first show that I got massively into, and then it was Dawson's Creek, and then it was mostly really Roswell and Dawson's Creek. Later, I came to Gilmore Girls. I'm trying to remember. Gilmore Girls was a little bit late. It was later, but it was like 2002. Something like
early
that.
Early 2000, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was very into Gilmore Girls. And it's interesting when, you know, when we look back at these, like, heroines of WBTV, they all have, like, a very similar sort of, like, innocence and blank canvasness. Although they all have, you know, very different personalities. But there was a sort of, like, openness, which I think on the one hand I related to, and on the other hand I understand now as a creator why that is troubling and kind of problematic to do, and why, like, it's hard, you know, even a few years later. So we're talking 2008 with I'm pretty sure with the release of The Vampire Diaries, Elena mm-hmm. is like, I mean, still like, you know, sweet, open-hearted, but like has already had a boyfriend, has already had sex, has lived this whole life before yeah. we meet her. And she's only, I think, like a sophomore or junior in high school. So even in those few, like those 7 years, I think just culture and television change a lot.
Well, it's funny you say that, because it makes me think about female protagonists on television in general. You know, I think the WB obviously was a network. They knew that their demos skewed relatively female, so they had a fair amount of female protagonists. But, you know, all of them were very drawn very differently. You know what I mean? Buffy is very different from Joey Potter, from...
Oh, yeah. Buffy, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's all very interesting to see how drastically different a lot of these characters are. And then, you know, and then you have Gilmore Girls. It is interesting the spectrum that they exist on, and that they all seem very sort of independently minded, very sort of empowered. A lot of them were written, some were written by women, so you definitely had that sort of component to it as well. But at the same time, it does feel, and I am leading to a question for you, is the question of does a female protagonist have to choose a man at the end of whatever this thing is? If it's a book, if it's a TV show, if it's a movie, I do feel like we still kind of demand that of our female characters and we don't of our male characters. And I wonder what that says and how you feel about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think for one, it's a challenging like apples to apples argument because there were just so few shows of that ilk that were centered around male protagonists. I'm trying to think of, there was like Jack and Bobby for, there was what?
Dawson.
Yeah. Dawson. Yeah. Although like it was, I mean, like it's so sad to talk about Dawson because you're like, it was his show and his creep, but like no one cared about him.
The worst
like,
character.
He was the worst. Like nobody cared. Yeah. Love James Van Der Beek, think he's the best, but like
he's lovely.
But like truly just like just nobody cared about that. So that was a whole thing. But you're right, like it was meant to be his show, but it really did evolve to being Joey and Pacey's show, I think.
I guess it's more about the fact that even if you step outside the WB and you just kind of look at a television in general, I just think that male characters don't have that hung around their neck. Whereas female characters do. Oh. I mean, I think it's a bummer that like Felicity is a show about a woman, you know, probably from the age of, let's just say 18 to 22, probably something in that range. And she has to pick a soulmate by the end of it is fucking crazy. Like she should be able to end the series being unsure. Like even if she chooses Ben, right? We should get the sense that she's unsure if this is a forever thing. And I guess there's sort of a patness to the way that is demanded upon female characters and isn't demanded on male characters.
Yeah.
Carrie Bradshaw has to end up with someone at the end of Sex and the City, even though, if we're being honest, probably she ends up alone. Oh. And I don't say that as a judgment on Carrie, but like, so do you sort of know what I'm saying?
I always say that about Sex and City. Like, it was the show about so many truths that ended with the biggest lie. Which is that the show that was based on the truth of what it means to be a woman and what it means to be single and what it means to be in your 30s. And then it ended with the biggest lie, which is that guy changes and he's the one you should be with. It was just like, it was crazy. But again, I think to your point, I think it was audience demanded. I mean, I think we're still trying to reorient women's stories to their own personal growth and development and not in terms of their love story. I mean, I think it's a question of the way that we have narrated, not just in television and film and books, but the way we've narrated our own lives, like what we value from women, you know, it's the ways in which like a 40-year-old dude who's crushing it at work is like a bachelor and he's awesome, but a 4-year-old woman is like problematic if she's unmarried. These social norms, even though we are doing active work to change them, they're still really pervasive throughout our culture, and I think they start really young. So it's not surprising to me that this exists. I mean, I think we do have examples now of television that is trying to move away from that. That's trying to like, you know, do the thing where it like permeates the narrative of culture, and those two things can kind of like be in communication with each other. But I think of a lot of it has to do with just the value system we place on women from the age of like, I mean, even princess books, like we talk about, you know, Disney, it all ends with a prince. Every single story ends with a man. And that's for 3-year-olds. It's not great.
Yeah. It's so funny you say that. Cause like, as you were talking, I was like, yeah, we have to earlier in children's lives, we have to stop sort of putting these preconceived notions on what a life is supposed to look like. And I say that just because, I mean, I feel it today. I still feel like there's things where society is demanding these things of me, which is unfair. Like, life is the way your life plays out. And you know, whatever makes you happy, and as long as it doesn't hurt other people, should be paramount. Like, everything else is just moot. But to your point, you know, if you watch all these Disney movies, and I will argue that it does feel a little bit like they're trying. Like, Moana, for instance, you know, or Frozen, like, these movies are trying to kind of shift away from these paradigms a little bit, which is helpful for sure. But I think that we have to do better, you know, on these shows that are aimed at teens. So that, you know, this idea that what sort of, you know, society deems right or wrong or what have you, I think is silly.
Anyway. And also, I think it's like, how do you tell a love story that feels like it has massive stakes, but that the stakes don't have to be solved at a certain point? Do you know what I mean? I think that's part of it, is that like, when you set up a love story and it feels like, you know, in a lot of these shows, the love story is the main stake of the show. There is no supernatural element. I mean, even in the Vampire Diaries, that love story is so paramount to the supernatural element. So how do you have a show that has stakes and doesn't feel like it needs to like solve for those stakes at the end, those stakes being romantic? How can it make a different choice?
I totally agree.
We're working on it.
I think we are. I mean, I just pitched something yesterday to someone and sort of was kind of expounding on this idea of, you know, romance stories not feeling so pat, not feeling so binary, this idea of that a romance can be a feeling. You know, some of my favorite movies that have romance in them or romantic relationships are, you know, Before Sunrise or In the Mood for Love, or these movies that have these sort of very kind of, they're really more tone poems than they are anything else. It's just sort of like living in moments between people, because ultimately that's what this all comes down to. And yeah. I think that Felicity actually does a pretty good job of living in those moments, but I agree with you that we need to do better, but you know, we're trying.
We're in process.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. I hope you had a good time.
This was honestly just like the best hour of my week. I loved it. Like, thank you so much for having me. This is so fun.
Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it. 1999. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.